You're listening to LawPod UK from the creators of the UK Human Rights Blog. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row and is presented by Rosalind English.
Earlier this month, the Royal Opera House was found liable for failing to protect the hearing of its musicians and for causing acoustic shock to a former viola player, Chris Goldschneider. This is the first time a musical institution has been found responsible for damage to the hearing of its musicians, and also the first time that acoustic shock has been recognised as an injury sounding in damages. On today's podcast, we have singer and composer Susie Self to give the musician's perspective on the ruling. Susie has wide experience in the musical world, from symphony and opera composition to conducting and singing solo roles in opera houses all over the world. Susie, thank you very much for coming on this Law podcast.
It's my pleasure.
Shall we jump straight in here and look at the Royal Opera House's defence to this claim? They said that the noise at work regulations, on which Mr. Goldschneider based his claim, only concerned noise that was a byproduct of an employee's activities. But the noise produced by the professional orchestra is the product. What do you make of this distinction?
Well, it's paradoxical, and I don't really think it holds any ground, because obviously the music is, as well as a product, it is a byproduct, the sound. And I think the Opera House could have found solutions to protect this player from the excesses of the brass section by relocating the brass section in the sides of the lower stalls, which is what they do when they're doing contemporary opera, which involves a lot of extra percussion. So they're able to go out there, or you could put the extra brass at the back of the stage and have an assistant conductor with a video link to the conductor. So I don't really see how they can say that. I mean, if you're working on the stage and a piece of scenery falls on you, that's a pretty catastrophic disaster, and there's health and safety regulations, and I would have thought this was exactly the same.
I suppose that takes us to the second question that I was going to ask you, that this ruling hits orchestras that play for opera rather than orchestral music more strongly, because obviously the players are in this enclosed space, the pit, rather than up on the stage.
Well, yes, I think that's true to an extent. I mean, if you go to an LSO concert at the Barbican, it's commonplace to see these Perspex screens in place where the brass are playing to save the ears of the string and woodwinds in front of them. I mean, it's quite a big pit at the Royal Opera House, so I'm not entirely convinced that it wouldn't be logistically possible to put those screens up. But there are other ways in which you could protect the musicians from the sound. You could locate the very heavy brass. I read about this case, and it actually occurred on one specific performance of Die Walküre, which, of course, Wagner has a very heavy brass section. But they could be situated, for example, at the back of the stage with an assistant conductor with a video relay to coordinate it, or on the sides of the lower stalls where, as I said, sometimes when they're doing contemporary opera, they're forced by the multitude of percussion instruments to bleed out into those areas anyway.
Oh, so that's very interesting. So, in fact, the classic architecture, if you like, of the placement of the orchestra could just be completely rethought.
Yes, you could easily protect the orchestra from the excesses of that huge brass section, either by screens, or because it is a particularly large orchestra for Wagner, you could put them in the sides and put screens up too. I can't see why they didn't even think to do that, because these screens have been in existence for, I would say, at least 20 years.
Can I ask you about the other form of protection these musicians could have taken or had impressed upon them, which is earplugs? What is your experience of that?
I've never used earplugs myself, although I've sung with orchestras in Mahler symphonies and so forth, where they're right close up to me. I haven't had experienced any trauma. I mean, the problem with the earplugs, although they claim that you can hear what you need to hear and they protect you from the excesses of the brass and the percussion, I think the nuances of being a string player require such refined tuning that it would be very difficult to differentiate from those sounds. So it would be an impediment. And when you consider top London players are under an enormous duress to play exquisitely in tune, and if they don't meet those standards, they could be sacked. So I think it could be very traumatic for a musician to have to deal with that extra element.
So in fact, from what you're saying, the Perspex screen would be more possible for the employer to impose as a sort of obligatory safety device rather than earplugs?
Well, it's a bit of a surprise to me because, as I said before, I mean, these screens are always in place in concert halls now, and everybody appreciates that. I don't know the scientific effectiveness of the screens, but obviously what you want to avoid is this very traumatic, loud sound going too close to somebody's ear hole. I mean, whether they're a musician or a stage manager, it's the same thing. It can have a very catastrophic effect. And in this case, the player ended up with permanent tinnitus, which is extremely unpleasant.
And I mean, I think I probably can predict your answer to this, but I'll ask you this anyway, that an immediate response to this case and indeed the result of it was to say, well, you know, you're a musician and you voluntarily go and play an orchestra. What can you expect?
Yeah, that's a really interesting case. But of course, things have moved on enormously in the last 50 years in terms of research into how hearing works, into natural hearing degeneration, which, of course, I don't know the age of this player, but it's quite normal for even a good hearing person to lose acuity as they go into middle age. And this is because the little hairs in the inner ear start to degenerate. But obviously, if you traumatise them more, they're going to go more quickly. But I think to say it's an occupational hazard would be like saying if you're working on a building site, well, you know, if you get killed, it's an occupational hazard. Whereas we know, you know, any kind of builder who has a catastrophic event, you know, we'll end up in court, and it's not acceptable because we can avoid it, and obviously it can be avoided.
So there are mitigating effects that can be taken, not just by the employee, him or herself, but by the employer in all situations.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask you a little bit from your research into this topic, because I understand you've done some research into the various types of hearing losses, not just to string players, but to all sorts of musicians, and not just in an orchestral situation.
Well, yeah, it's quite a dangerous thing being a musician, to be honest, because, for example, the oboe, if you're talking to a specialist about hearing loss, really you shouldn't practice an oboe for more than an hour a day. And singing, particularly high singing, sopranos or tenor, they suffer more hearing loss. And so they need to reduce their hours in using their voice because they're actually getting the sound, the worst effects of the sound directly to them. But I think that one's got to be a little bit more philosophical. I mean, people undertake all kinds of amazing activities, which we wouldn't say you can't sail around the world. You know, you take some risks, but I think it's important that employers are held to account to avoid the worst excesses of the risk. And here is one situation where it really could have been quite easily avoided, I think.
I suppose you have answered my question, but may I'll put it to you in another way, which is why would a brass player injure a third party more than he or she would injure himself? Because he's playing the instrument.
Yes.
Why are his ears not suffering?
Yes. Well, his ears or her ears will be suffering, but probably not as catastrophically as the person in front of them. Because if you look at the instrument, a trumpet, for example, it's got this bell at the end, and which is designed to blast the sound out of the end of the instrument, and that sound is then blasting into the person in front of you, and it's not blasting into your ear. So in terms of all classical music, whether you're a singer or a player, the whole purpose of these instruments is to project the sound out. So although there may be some problems, it's usually with the instruments that are more intimately involved with your physique, hence singers. And it's very common for singers, for example, to start to notice some hearing loss in the middle tones of their voice, so that they often feel that their voice is becoming less strong as they head into middle age, but actually it's probably more likely that they can't hear those tones so clearly, and so they struggle with that. But I think, you know, one has to, as I said before, balance the pleasure of making music and the dangers.
That's very interesting perspective on it. And I just wanted to finish on, perhaps this is a rather unfair question to ask of you because you're a classical musician rather than pop musician, but it, to me anyway, it was surprising that this first case should arise out from a classical context, because one thinks of a pop concert as being a far noisier affair.
Yes, it is extraordinary. Who knows? I mean, people already are suspicious that there are going to be a lot more young people who are going to suffer catastrophic hearing loss into their middle age because of disco music and the levels that are allowed to be generated through electronic media is outrageous, you know. And I think really disco clubs and so forth, concert venues should be held to account over those levels.
So possibly if you're a top pop musician playing in a concert, it makes so much money it's worth the risk.
I don't think it's ever worth the risk to lose your hearing, because, you know, actually it's our social medium. And my grandfather was profoundly deaf the last 5 years of his life. And I mean, it's a very, very sad situation.
Yes.
Not easily resolved.
And of course, if you're a musician, you can't just fix it by putting hearing aids in, because that presumably makes the whole situation a lot worse.
Mm. Well, the thing we all know about hearing aids is that they offer sound, but they don't ever replicate the sound that you would naturally hear. So it's not quite as simple as using glasses, for example. And a lot of people struggle with hearing aids, however sophisticated they are. When they're in a space with lots of people, they can't differentiate between the person they're talking to, the other sounds. So I think really, if you were talking to a sound hearing expert, they would always recommend that you should try and protect your ears as best as possible. And I don't see any reason. There have been musicians who've gone into old age without hearing loss, so it's not a given.
It's not a given in the same way that losing your becoming short-sighted is a given, or rather, yeah, long-sighted.
Well,
long-sighted.
I think it's a given that you will lose some nuance in your hearing ability. That is true. But to actually go deaf or have a perpetual tinnitus is really unacceptable if it's a result of an injury from too much sound being too close to the ear, which was the case in this one.
Where the proximity could be changed by shifting,
yes,
the architecture.
Yes, it's a bit. Just common sense.
Yeah. Well, thank you for bringing some musical common sense to this very interesting case.
Yeah.
I think there's been a lot of discussion about the law on it, but it's very good to have a performer's perspective on it. So thank you,
yes,
Susie.
Thank you. Thank you.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.